What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Nightmare on Film Street is brought to you by Baphomet & Co., small batch soap inspired by horror and the macabre. This week's pick is the Dybbuk Box, the mystery gift set. Feeling brazen, curious, eager to conjure a little mystery? Baphomet & Co.'s Dybbuk Box contains an array of Baphomet & Co. curated scents, soaps, and bath products that will remain a complete mystery until the box arrives at your door. Get 10% off your order with the code NIGHTMARE at baphometandco.com. That's 10% off with code NIGHTMARE. Baphomet & Co. Made by hands, sometimes severed.
Fellow fiends, welcome to another terrifying and delectable episode of Nightmare on Film Street. The horror podcast with zero credibility, but all of the blood, ghouls, and gore your puny heart can handle. Let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome to another episode of Nightmare on Film Street. I'm John.
I'm Kim.
And this week we are talking cold-blooded killers with William Lustig's Maniac and John McNaughton's Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Correction, John. We are talking controversial killers.
Ooh, my mistake. We are talking controversial killers because both of these movies, there are some controversial opinions, even on this episode, about their quality and need to exist.
Not quality, just merit.
All right, well, you know, if you listened to last week's mini episode, I think you know exactly where we stand. And, let emotion get the best of me, maybe, last week. Point is, I'm very excited to talk about these movies. I was very excited to watch them with Kim.
I was not.
Kim was also there while I watched them, is kind of what it comes down to. Before we get into it, though, it is Cold-Blooded Killers Month here at Nightmare on Film Street, both in the podcast and at nofspodcast.com. So if you like your fill of grimy 80s killers...
Sometimes some snow.
Sometimes some snow, of course, like Santa, biggest killer of all.
Yeah, what I've been seeing.
We have an entire episode dedicated to diabetes. It's the silent killer that's sweeping the nation, and we gotta do something about it.
Cold-blooded.
Legit, though, between Kim and I... all of our parents have diabetes.
Oh my god.
Right? I gotta stop eating candy.
You do.
I have a sweet tooth.
You were literally like, Skittles yesterday.
All right.
It was kind of scary.
All right, well, we know what's keeping me unhealthy at the very least. Kim, what's keeping you creepy this week?
Some movies coming out this weekend. We've got In Fabric, the super cool haunted dress movie that we finally watched back at Sleepy Hollow Film Festival. That is hitting, is it select theaters and VOD?
Yep.
Peter Strickland, I can't talk about it too much other than the fact that it is like a visual feast. There's lots of red. Everybody loves red.
Yep.
And there's a haunted dress. What more could you ask for?
Super weird movie. Definitely for you David Lynch fans out there, I would think. But also another movie from Spectrevision, the people that brought you Mandy and the upcoming Colorado Space have Adam Egypt Mortimer's Daniel Isn't Real, also hitting select theaters.
Probably my one of my favorite posters of 2019.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's a poster that I loved before the movie, and then now looking at it after having seen the movie, holy shit.
Pretty good.
You guys are going to like this movie a lot. It's nuts. It's weird. It's got some really gross shit, but it's also just like maybe probably the best psychological horror of the year. Maybe. You see it for yourselves this weekend. Let me know what you thought.
And Knives Out came out last weekend, so...
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, those of you who spent your Thanksgivings with... your new film family.
Oh, man. What was
Jamie Lee Curtis, Toni Collette, everybody else.
Oh, please. Yeah, but what was it like going from like maybe a hostile dinner at your own family's house to seeing a movie in the theater about a hostile dinner that ends in murder at somebody else's house? I really liked it. We saw it at Fantastic Fest. I thought it was way funnier than I thought it was going
to
be.
Unfortunately, like, I need to see it again.
Let's go.
We'll probably see it before it finishes its theater run because I honestly... apart from remembering the ending, I don't really remember a whole lot about it. I remember liking it.
Yeah.
But not like, it seems like everybody really loved it. So like, that's great. I hope I like it that much on second watch.
It's a really cool murder mystery. I mean, like, it's not too often that we have like Agatha Christie type murder mysteries anymore. And I think you could agree, because last night,
it was Sunday, John.
Sunday night. You were dying for one, and we couldn't find one. You wanted a modern one, specifically. Basically, you wanted a movie to watch after watching Knives Out. Now, if you were to broaden your perspective a little bit and include older movies...
I just wanted a BBC one. That's what I wanted.
Totally.
I just wanted a British one.
I guess the TLDR version of this question is, what movies would you recommend to people after having seen Knives Out if they would like another a little more murder mystery in their lives?
Clue.
Okay, you've heard it here on the podcast. Watch Clue again.
I was going to say Murder on the Orient Express, but like I don't recommend that one.
There's a lot of versions of that movie.
One of them.
Yeah, you could watch Death on the Nile.
Not Clue.
Nah, just Clue.
Just Clue.
Yeah.
Pick a different ending. It's a fresh movie.
You may have heard about this movie a little bit. Now when I look at lists of like, 10 movies to watch after seeing Knives Out, I'm seeing this movie on that list. Up until earlier this year, completely unheard of for me. I'd never heard of it. Sounded strange. Probably the best murder mystery I've seen in a very long time. The Last of Sheila. Takes place mostly on a boat.
You made us watch that like 2 years ago.
Was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's always impressive when the Song of the Summer lasts more than one summer. You know, and here we are.
It's California Girls.
Really good.
They're undeniable. Last of Sheila is still on top.
Nice. Ian McShane's in it. Super great. In the 70s, Ian McShane. Written by Anthony Perkins, who of course you know from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, based on actual murder mysteries that they would throw for their friends. Anyway, it's a really cool movie. Really strange. Very good Hollywood movie too, if you like Hollywood movies. But I would highly recommend it. Other movies that are coming out, if you don't feel like going to the theater, you can check out I know nothing about it. There's a true crime documentary coming to Netflix about Henry Lee Lucas called The Confession Killer, because I think we talk about it a little bit in this podcast.
We do.
Yeah.
Because believe it or not, we're talking about the fictionalized version of Henry Lee Lucas called Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yeah, I mean, it could not have come in a better time. We did not plan this.
We didn't?
Nope, not at all. But I get the impression it's going to be very similar to the Ted Bundy documentary that came out earlier this year, mostly based on tapes. But yeah, Henry Lee Lucas, real piece of work, but, you know, confessed to... 300 murders or something stupid like that, which is probably all fake, mostly fake, but
who knows?
Yeah, really don't know.
I'm really pumped for that documentary.
Yeah, it might be good.
Yeah. When does that come out?
December 6th, this week. And
dope.
Yeah. We'll have a review on the site also, so if you're not sure if it's worth your time, you can head over to nofspodcast.com, check it out.
Cool. Before we send you to the meat of the episode, just a reminder that we are doing Krampus cards again this year. If you are a patron of Nightmare on Film Street, you're going to get a Christmas card from John and I.
Hell yeah.
We do it every year just to thank those of you who support us. And 2019 was a big year for us in terms of like getting on the road and traveling and stuff. So We wanted to make a special card for you guys. If you want to get a Krampus card and you are not yet a patron, we are actually still open. There's still time to send them out. So we made our cutoff December 12th. Yeah, so as long as you pledge by the 12th, you're going to get a Krampus card. Any later than that, though, I don't think we'd be able to get them out in time for Christmas. So.
Yeah, definitely not before Krampus shows up. Now, we also haven't field tested it, but I do think that if Krampus comes to steal your kids and you show him the card,
it's like a get-out-of-Krampus free card, I think. I wouldn't want to test it out, but I mean, if you ever find yourself patient, like, he might be flattered.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe cover all your bases and take a little bit of your firstborn's blood to smear across the door, just to be safe.
But you can head to patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet to check out our Patreon page and all of our rewards and perks and all that stuff.
Right after that cutoff next week, actually, Friday the 13th, we will be hosting one of our monthly live streams of the Friday the 13th game.
Oh yeah, because December has a Friday the 13th in it.
Hell yeah, it does. And you know, if you're worried, you're like, hey, I already got plans. I'm gonna be watching Joe Bob. We are too. Don't worry. We are only holding you until from 7 to 8:59 because we need just enough time to switch over, see Ernie wearing his little cap.
Oh, Ernie.
Yeah, and then probably watch Black Christmas, I would assume.
Yeah, probably.
Or a bunch of Silent Night, Deadly Nights. What do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. Oh, it's going to be Deadly Games, that new movie that they just added.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
That's what I'm hoping for. I haven't watched it yet, so like this will be perfect because I haven't had time, and I've already designated that as my Shudder time, so.
Okay, that's enough fun and games. Let's talk about two movies that are huge downers because they are just dealing with some of the worst people to walk this earth. Just some real cold-blooded killers. Let's start off by talking probably about the most controversial of these two movies, at least based on who's sitting in this room. Let's talk about 1980s.
Somebody out there? There's somebody over there. I see somebody over there.
Maniac is a repulsive story of a berserk killer in New York. This is an extremely brutal film that thoroughly grossed me out. And what sent me out of the theater so early was the scene where we see a head hit by a shotgun blast and it explodes in slow motion. That came after a couple of throat slashings and a vicious strangulation. Maniac is making its slimy way into theaters all around the country, so be on the lookout for it and avoid it.
You know, sometimes that's a very valid reaction to just walk out on a film like that, even if you're a movie critic, because as a civilized person, there's no point in sitting there and watching that kind of stuff.
There was no point at which the film was going to redeem itself after that. It was a real gross-out show.
From 1980, William Lustig's Maniac is currently sitting at a 39% on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.5 out of 10 on IMDb, 22% on Metacritic, and 3.4 out of 5 on Letterboxd. I didn't see all of the ratings for the newer, updated Maniac with Elijah Wood, but it also doesn't have a great Metacritic score. That's the only other place I saw it was like 44%. Oh, no, and I think it has like a 22 on Rotten Tomatoes. Anyway, people on Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic did not like this movie. Oh, one other thing here. It says that currently holds the Guinness World Book of Record for the sweatiest close-up. That's obviously not true, but is also true.
Yeah, so John's been wanting to talk about these movies on the podcast forever.
Hell yeah.
And I've put us off for a real long time.
Would you like to explain why?
Just because they're not enjoyable movies. So apologies if you had to sit through these for the first time and you had no idea what you're getting into, and then you're like, oh fuck, these are dark. It's all John's fault. He made us do this, and I couldn't hold off any longer.
And you're welcome,
John,
everybody.
You have the floor.
Yay. Do you not like... okay, I'm not going to direct this at you. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have a appreciation for like those gritty, grimy, sleazy New York, Chicago movies of the early 80s.
You just wanted to watch Taxi Driver.
which we did before we did these movies.
And then you just doubled down.
That's not, you're really drawing a line between some things that have happened in the last, like, few weeks and the last year and a half of me trying to watch this. I think it was sparked by the 4K restoration that Blue Underground was putting out last year, and I just have held off watching it since then, and I'm so happy to finally be here. I have been wanting to watch Maniacs for so long! I think both of these movies, but Maniac especially, is one of those great grindhouse movies of the early 80s that shows you a New York that just doesn't exist. And, you know, as much as, you know, it's fun to be like, oh, I'd love to see that place, it looks horrible. It does not look like the kind of place you'd want to grow up or go to the movies. But I like watching it from the comfort of my own home.
Okay. Cool.
And I also just think it's a great little movie that puts you in the mind of a madman.
Yeah. So I had seen this movie once previous.
Yes.
And I didn't really remember a whole lot about it apart from Tom Savini's scene. So, but I did remember, like, I don't know if I necessarily visually remembered, like, his mannequin thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I just knew he had a mannequin thing.
Yeah.
And to be fair, like, my brain did a pretty good job of remembering just enough of that movie that I still have all of it. Like, I still, like Tom Savini's death and the mannequin thing, like, not even a visual of the mannequin thing. Like, oh, I get Maniac. Like, I got it.
That's all, you just had a bullet point that said mannequins in your brain.
Mannequin thing, Tom Savini squish.
Tom Savini squish. Oh.
Yeah. It is fucking uncomfortable to watch this movie. And if you're into feeling uncomfortable and, like, squidgy in your seat, this is definitely the movie for you. But for the majority of the movie going public, film is supposed to be, like, escapism. And this movie is, like, escaping into, like, a rat's den.
Yeah.
And getting trapped there. So I understand the Rotten Tomatoes rating, because wow, this movie is very uncomfortable. And huh. There's a lot I appreciate about this movie. It's got some really interesting ideas, and it presents some really unique perspectives, particularly that of a psychopath. And also the special effects are awesome. But I can't say that I like watching it.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, I respect the movie, but my rating at the end is going to be how much I like it, and it's going to be very low, and you're going to be upset.
I'm not going to be upset.
You are going to be upset.
I'm going to be surprised.
I'm warning you now.
I'm going to be hurt.
I'm telling you
now.
I'm
going to feel let down. I'm not going to be mad. Wow. Has there been any other movie we've talked about on the podcast where you've had to, like,
warn you?
Just a heads up.
I don't think so. I don't know.
I feel like we should do it now and then roll backward through the movie. No.
No, let's talk about the movie because it's not going to taint how I talk about the movie. Because as good. I said, I there's a lot I respect about the movie, but I don't like watching it.
Okay, that's fine. I'm glad to hear that. I kind of want to narrow in on what it is about the movie that you have a hard time watching. Is it just the things that Frank the Maniac does? Is it how it's filmed? Like, is it just because it has that, like, super gritty, low budget, maybe you're kind of there for it moments, like Last
House
on the Left?
What I don't like about this movie is also kind of what I give it credit for.
Okay.
In that it's not glamorizing at all to what a serial killer's mentality and lifestyle would be like. He's very sweaty. He's he's gross. Like,
yeah.
And when he's murdering people and you have to see, like, his face, like, bearing down on them, like, that gives me, like, a physical response. Like, I don't like that. Particularly the sequence where he attacks the nurse. There's something so, like, helpless about it, and, like, realistic, I guess, and watching somebody being hunted and then them being powerless, and also, like, me being a powerless viewer and also, like, a witness getting entertainment out of it. Like, I just really don't like being put in that situation, to the film's credit. Does that make sense?
Then that makes total sense. What of those things bothers you the most? So what I'm breaking down there is, like, we've got some POV shots basically from the victim's perspective. Like, when we're seeing when we're seeing Joe Spinell's like sweaty, greasy face, we're supposed to be looking up at him as he's strangling us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, like there is a woman who is trying to get away in a subway late at night.
And she has good, like spidey sense. She has a good, like she's smart and I want her to survive, but she is a woman who's taking the subway at night from work in a busy city, and she has a good sense for when things are wrong, because there's nothing that tips her off to this guy until he's actually murdering her. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's just running from the vibe she gets from him.
But you still respect that how it's put together and how it's presented, and I'm wondering if it's that. It's like you do like that scene, but you don't like that. I that's what I'm trying to break into, because like you're saying about getting enjoyment out of it as a viewer, like what is it about that?
Well, just like the act of viewership, like the voyeurism of it.
Okay.
I feel it makes me feel dirty as a horror fan.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Oh, that totally makes sense.
Because it's gratuitous in its grittiness.
Yeah. Okay.
And like,
do you think if this was flashier, you'd have no problem with it?
If we played the maniac character more for yucks, I think it would soften where he's stalking and attacking women, and it's very, very like dry and dirty. So like none of his character traits are actually played for yucks. Like any of the like ha 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 moments are kind of on us. Like the only sort of silly moment is when he's talking to one of the mannequins. I think it's actually the nurse, and he's brushing out her hair, and her hair's all bloody, and he's just like, "Oh, you got blood in your hair," and like you kind of laugh as like a horror fan, because I mean it's a little silly visually. It's got like this naughty scalp of hair. I'm rolling my eyes saying that, but it's like covered in blood, and her outfit's bloody, and it's just a silly vignette. But when you think about it on face value, like, it's fucking twisted.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy twisted. It's funny because
his apartment would smell so bad.
It would be fucking disgusting. He basically just lives in a dumpster pile. And there's so much stuff everywhere,
like, rotting scalps.
Oh.
And him stapling them on their head. Like, it's a little silly, but there's nothing else silly. There's nothing. Well, it's not actually silly.
No, it's not silly. It's a very humorless movie. But for how crazy it is, like, it is so macabre. It's in the same way you would laugh at this movie the same way you laugh at scenes in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is in a lot of ways humorless, but it's how like regular things are happening in a very irregular way. Like, we are watching his morning routine, and a morning routine for everybody is just normal, and it's normal for him, and he doesn't approach things as though he's doing them in a uncommon way. It's very like there's secondhand to,
yeah,
him.
There's a sense of like
familiarity.
Routine.
Yeah, routine. I think it's.
Do you remember the moment where I jumped?
I do. It was the nurse. I okay. I was gonna bring that up. You definitely had a very uncomfortable time watching the. No, sorry. You had a very uncomfortable time watching the nurse in the subway, especially where she's hiding. And I think part of it was just like those uncontrollable responses that she was like. She was like.
Oh,
and
she was making little noises.
Yeah, and it's just like you can see that she's fighting it, and it's like, why would you make that sound? It's just like she doesn't want to make that sound, man. But like, it's just coming out because she's absolutely terrified. And then like, yeah, there's a moment where she thinks she's gotten away and everything's cool, and he comes up behind her. But when he attacks Rita, the model, that one got like a genuine jump out of you.
I don't even remember because I was like so, I was drinking Pepsi and. I jumped so much, I spilt the Pepsi all over myself.
Yeah.
I have never done that in a movie.
And like, it's not like
spilt my drink on myself.
It wasn't a moment like a James Wan built scare. You didn't have to like lock into it and really get into it. It was just like a gritty. He's got a knife pressed against her skin. We see shots between their eyes. Like he's really into it. She's really scared. And then he stabs her. Like it was very sort of routine at this point in the movie. But just. I don't know, like maybe the real to life aspect of it just like really, really gotcha.
Yeah.
It was an experience to watch this movie with you because it really got under your skin. You know, I think maybe now is a good time to bring up how much Gene Siskel hated this movie. We don't have a rating from Roger Ebert for it. There's no rating on the website. And in the Siskel and Ebert at the Movies television show, they didn't really talk about it too much, other than that Gene Siskel really goes to town on explaining how horrible this movie is and how vile it is. And he also says that he walked out of the movie after Tom Savini got his head blown off. And he says there's no way that anything redeemable is going to happen in the movie, and there's no good message, and I didn't want to waste my time watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, whatever. I mean, I've heard him talk about that kind of stuff before. He also went on this big, long campaign because a Chicago theater was playing clips from the movie outside of the theater in broad daylight for anybody to look at. So, like, they were playing murder set pieces outside.
That's a little.
that's maybe a little much. I don't know that I necessarily do that. The only thing that bugged me about Roger Ebert was coming to his defense by saying that, like, even as critics, where it's our job to watch these movies, there's no reason for a civilized person to have to sit through that. And it's like, what do you, maybe get to the end of the fucking movie. Like, there's
yeah, but John,
more to
sometimes
this.
Like, for some people, this isn't cinema. So, like, for some people, this is just gratuitous violence.
Okay.
And you can kind of see where they're coming from, because some people don't want to be, like, brought to the brink of entertainment.
Yeah. Agreed. I think this movie could also be called Maniac, A Portrait of a Serial Killer. You know, the fact that we don't have a name in front, like, it could be called Frank, A Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is a really interesting movie because we follow Frank in Frank's life. Frank is a horrible person.
It's it's just like 3 weeks with Frank.
Yeah, okay, I know. See, it is a cycle of Frank. Because Frank...
Like, oh no, Frank's gone manic again. That's what we're watching.
I think this happens every year. That's what I'm saying. Like, first off, like, you could make an argument that the first person that he kills at the beginning of the movie is the first person he has killed before. But he seems way too good at it and way too prepared.
Didn't he already have a mannequin in his bed?
Well, I think it might have been that mannequin from the beginning of the movie. Like, I think we don't necessarily see him build that first mannequin,
yeah,
right? He just has the mannequin, and then he goes out and he kills again, and then we see him put the scalp on. But he talks to all of these mannequins as though they are a specific person. And even when he's killing his second victim, the prostitute, is going to take him around the world. No, the ultimate. She's going to give him the ultimate. like, we are seeing flashes of another woman. So we know that he...
is,
like,
visualizing.
Yeah, like, we're... like the movie,
I mean, we can all guess its mother, but...
I think we can all guess its mother now, but I think in 1980, that was a pretty interesting angle. Like, yeah, we've got Psycho and stuff, but, like, the analysis of serial killers was very... it was a burgeoning field at that time.
Yeah, well, and plus the 80s... 70s and 80s, I think, were the height of the American serial killer.
Yeah.
Because it was...
119 serial killers in the 70s.
Well,
we started editing an article recently.
Yeah, like, it was... free love, young people were hitchhiking on highways, like truck drivers and people who used truck driving as an outlet had access, and law enforcement didn't communicate between states. Like, it was a time to be able to get away with that kind of stuff. And I mean, thankfully now we have, like, DNA and fingerprinting, and we have some things that slow it down a little bit. But it's crazy when you think of the, like, there's no way that we have less people who have the potential to
become serial
killers. It's just harder for them to be serial killers, so they're not.
Yeah.
Don't you wonder if there are, like, people that you've met or known in your life that, like, you're like, oh yeah, that person's crazy. But, like, what if they really actually could have been in another decade?
Oh yeah. That's the nutters part about it. Like, and I think maybe just a bunch of people that are in jail for a single murder maybe are probably like those people.
Oh, true. Like, they got caught. Yeah,
after one. Yeah.
Or, yeah, like, people who do, like, home invasions and stuff and just never had the potential to, like, ramp up to that. Because, like, I know one of our biggest serial killers in Canada started out as, like, a home invasion rapist and worked his way up to murder. And, like, now, thanks to DNA and everybody having, like, cameras in their front stoops.
Yeah.
We're able to catch those people before they evolve into murderers, I guess.
I think that's one way to describe it.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're in the Silence of the Lambs universe, that's definitely the right word for it.
Yeah.
But Maniac for me, like, gives it's an in, I'm trying to use the right words because I don't want to make it sound like I'm too much of a voyeur in this scenario. But yeah, like, it's a movie, so like, I know it's not real. It's fine. And yes, unfortunately, very unfortunately, these are real to life people. So it is speaking to a darkness that exists in our real world. But to see his manic cycle is really interesting because he is a very specific type of killer, and he has very specific rituals and how he does things, and it's so weird and removed from a world I know that it's just a really interesting character study.
Yeah, you almost feel every opportunity we get to go into his little apartment or his bachelor pad or whatever we're calling it, you almost feel like you get to be a detective and you're like scouring his walls.
Yes, yeah.
And trying to figure out why things are the way they are. Like, I'm not looking at it as like, oh, they dressed his set like this. Like, there was a reason why he scratched the breasts and the...
Yes,
like,
yeah.
Like, the pubic area off that nudie photo. There's a reason why, I swear to God, there are bubbles on his dresser. But he eats, like, Cracker Jacks.
He eats
like,
Cracker Jacks while he's packing up his guitar case or violin case filled with, like, a machete and a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, there is a childlike aspect to him that he is really wallowing in. So, like, we know, as we go through the movie, we learn more and more about his backstory through the conversations that he has with mannequins. More than anything else. Like,
yeah.
there is a mumblecore version of this movie that exists just inside that apartment where we never see the killer.
Him actually murdering?
Yeah.
And it's just in...
Yeah, we see a guy doing his morning routine and leaving with weapons and coming back
like, there's
with
a new
a
hairstyle.
Yeah, like, he comes back with a mannequin and a scalp and he talks to it. And that's how we learn about the mother that left him. Like, it does not sound like she was necessarily a great mother. By all accounts, she was... But I mean, we really don't know anything. Like,
we don't know if it's true.
Yeah, we definitely don't know if it's true. We don't know to what extent any of it's... Like, we don't know her story at all. We just know that she was either bringing a lot of men back home for work or just in her personal life, and he was exposed to it. And that at one point when she left, which was always his biggest fear, that his mother was never home, she never came back. She died in a car accident. At least that's what he tells Anna, the photographer that he meets in the strangest
and
second half
like,
of this movie.
She has real bad Spidey sense.
She does!
She's like, he's just like, oh yeah, you took my picture in the park. And then you're just like, oh, come in. You're my best friend now.
Yeah, there's
like,
no question about it.
What are you doing?
But here's the...
Just because he brushed his hair, he still looks like a creep.
He is very much a creep because... I don't know how he got her address. Like, why is that not the first question she asks? Like, I saw you in the park. You took my photo. I'm at your door now. That's a little nuts. That's a little crazy. But she's totally fine with it. And he's like, would you like to go out sometime? She's like, I'll be ready in 10. Like, they go out to dinner right away. And the craziest thing about that whole scenario is that he is kind of a normal person at dinner.
And he's like, fine. Like, a lot of times you think of these serial killers as being like incel guys and being... taking out their anger on women because they can't interact with them socially and they can't get love. They can't get a partner because they're not able to treat them like human beings.
Yeah.
And he's actually kind of flirty and suave.
Yeah,
and
he's really not
they're
that bad.
Eating cheesecake and it's just like, man, you could have a normal life. Like,
that is the surefire sign.
He's sitting with a 10. A 10!
She's incredible. But like, that is the surefire sign that they had a great dinner because I personally don't even stay for dessert in my own like outings with
well,
you.
Well, they're talking about they're talking about plans and stuff.
Yeah,
so, like, he's already got a second date with her before fucking cake's even done.
She invites him to his house while she's working to just like observe a photo shoot.
Her house.
What did I say?
His house.
My mistake.
He's not having anybody over to his
Can you imagine?
Ugh.
You know, like, I love thinking about this movie from the perspective of somebody else that lives in that building, that she says hello to him as he's coming home with a garbage bag filled with, I don't know, a Christmas tree, I guess. Do you think he steals those mannequins? Or do you think he buys the mannequin?
I don't know.
Because there are scenes where he's sort of like window
Looking
shopping
at
for them. Yeah, like,
yeah.
I think he... I don't know. I think if he broke into a place and stole a mannequin, we'd probably see it. Somehow he acquires a mannequin. And so, like, I'm barreling through this movie. Like, we didn't even really talk about Tom Savini's head explosion.
I do want to talk about it.
Yeah. Let's just take a break here. and talk about Tom Savini's head explosion.
Well, and there's a reason why I remember that scene. One, because it is very jarring and it's very visceral. Like, they blow up a fucking melon of guts. And this is probably true to not just Siskel, but a lot of people who turned off the movie probably turned it off at this point, because it is made very evident in this sequence, like this Lover's Lane sequence, that this film will have no redemption.
Okay.
None of these characters that we root for will have redemption. They will all, like, die crying at the end, at the barrel of a gun. And maybe that's why the slasher film has evolved to have that final girl, because there is always, like, a thread of redemption. And maybe redemption's not the right word.
Catharsis?
Yeah, like, we need to have something to hang on to, like hope and just like a sense of good in the world and that everything will work out okay. Because I think staring down the black tunnel of, like, what happens to people when they actually face these kinds of maniacs in the real world is, like, not somewhere our psyche can willingly go.
I hear you. And, like, I would definitely say that I appreciate nihilistic filmmaking a little more than you do. But
I like the idea of it.
And I like the idea of nihilism.
I'm okay with films like this existing.
Yeah.
But am I going to put this on my DVD shelf and revisit it every year? Like, I probably don't need to watch this movie ever again.
I am buying it on Blu-ray. Like, I am letting you know right now that at some point I'm buying that 4K restoration.
And honestly, I think I made up that decision when, like, after Tom Savini was shot, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. It's when the girlfriend gets shot in the face.
Yeah, that one's rough.
And I'm like, you'd think I'd be desensitized by now to, like, people being murdered in movies, but this film is really well crafted around making you feel the finiteness of their final scenes with him.
Yeah. The movie makes you feel helpless.
Like, and when he gets that model and, like, so when he holds her captive, like, it just,
it's, ugh. Yeah, no, it's tough. It's real tough. But it's interesting. Because
you think about it in her perspective, like, this creep.
She knows him.
Yeah, well,
she's met him.
She knows of him.
Yeah.
And he's got her tied up, and he's spewing, obviously, his, like, psychological break babble at her.
Yeah.
And all she can do is just try to figure out, like, okay, what is this guy's tick, and what possibly could I do to get out of it? Is there any opportunity? Is there any crack I can exploit? And there's no time for her to even get a bearing on the situation.
It's interesting you highlighting all of that, especially after talking about not having a final girl and how in a horror movie we have a final girl that gives us somebody to root for and somebody to hold on to, essentially. What's great about this movie is either that it has an incredible ability to give us that same feeling to everybody else we see. Like, Frank is such a horrible person.
It's because none of them transgress.
That's true. Nobody did anything wrong. Nobody did anything wrong. You're right. And you feel for them. You are with them in that moment. And there is such empathy for that person on screen. But you don't... there is no happy ending. So either it's to the film's credit that it's able to get such a connection between you and that character you've only just seen. Either because Frank is so bad or because they're so helpless. Or that just says something about us as people. Like, we know how bad Frank is, so the moment we see anybody else near him, we are scared for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's effective in doing it. And before we move away from it too much, because obviously we're talking just about, like, bigger motifs than the actual plot of the movie, Tom Savini's head explosion. Like, oh boy, like, top three head explosions of all time, right? Like, oh, it's so great.
Is it a compliment to be like, yeah, that looked real? Like,
sure, it's a compliment, because it's fake. It's not. The goal is to make it look as real as possible. I guess while still being enjoyable, so that's okay, sure, sure. We won't give it the number one spot.
No, then. it was very jarring. Yeah. Even knowing it was coming and even being like seeing that car pull up in my memory being like, oh, this is that scene. Like,
you know, the worst part about that whole scene, though, is that Tom Savini never sees it coming. And that's not, it's not his, it's not the worst because of that. It's because his girlfriend does. Like, there is a creepy guy an inch away from their window when they're making out in the back seat. And she immediately knows this is a bad scene and we got to get the fuck out of here. And it doesn't happen. Those eyes peering in at them are the scariest part of that whole scene.
Ugh.
If you probably already know this because it's like the one big story that gets circulated regarding Maniac. They did not have a lot of permits to shoot a lot of this movie. And they definitely did not have permits to shoot that head explosion scene. And I think that might even be why it's in slow motion. Because they only have such a little amount of tape.
Oh.
And they needed to stretch it out a little bit. But it also, it lingers the horror of that moment anyway. So I think it works, and they were probably always planning to do that. But after they shot Tom Savini's fake head and it exploded all over the car, they immediately got out of there. Like, they'd, like, towed the car away, put it in a garage, locked the doors, and walked away from the garage for, I don't know, months or something. And when they opened it back up, because Tom Savini's fake head had been stuffed with, like, shrimp and whatnot. Like, it's a lot of food particles, and it had just been sitting in a hot car for a long time. The car was so disgusting that apparently they just pushed it into the river, which does not seem like the right thing to do.
That's a big kind of littering.
But here's the thing. You've got a car, and it's got a shotgun blast through the windshield. There's what looks like a person in the front seat. There is gross, moldy, disgusting, awful-smelling stuff all over the car. How do you explain to somebody that it's not a real dead body? Like, you can't just bring it to a junkyard, I guess, and be like, hey, squash this for me. There's nothing illegal happening here.
We're filmmakers.
Yeah, and like, I don't think you were allowed to use firearms in filmmaking unless you had, like, the Warner Brothers permit, you know? Like, it was, New York was not having it at that time, so it was all kinds of illegal.
Mm.
So into the river it went. I'm still saying it's not a good idea.
I'm still thinking that's even worse, though, because imagine,
I think, if it is worse.
Imagine if they, like, found that car and they pull it out. Yeah, and just, like,
surely they did, right? Somebody had to have. And then the cops came and, like, okay, nothing to see here, folks. Just a dumb mannequin. Oh, well. So do you not find... So the ending of this movie I find so brilliant. I think it's so great. And, like, at one point, he takes Anna, who is kind of becoming his, like, weird girlfriend, although she really shouldn't be. He takes her on a drive. They're going out to dinner, but he's like, hey, do you mind if we stop at the graveyard so I can visit my mother first? And she's like, of course, that's not strange. I'll even come with you.
And then it's dark and foggy.
Foggy bog, yeah. But there we see her tombstone and we see that she had died in December. It is currently December because there are Christmas decorations. It's cold. Everybody's wearing thicker jackets. So this is it. Like, this is a cycle. He is always leading up to that night. I think he is so friendly with Anna because he needs to get close to her to get her to go to the cemetery. I think the goal was always to kill her at the cemetery at his mother's grave.
You think so? I thought he just cracked.
I don't know.
Because he was... So, there's a scene when he's not with Anna, but it's after he's met her, and he's, like, mannequin shopping, and he looks at a bride mannequin. I think he actually wants, like, maybe not necessarily a girlfriend, but a relationship with a girl that he can then turn her into a bride mannequin, and then he'll have, like, a wife.
Well, the bride mannequin thing is kind of... I think you're right. I think he's got a lot of problems with his mom. Like, I think he wants to kill her. I think he wants to live with her. I think he wants to marry her. And it's definitely a till death do us part and here for eternity kind of thing. Because he especially says to all the mannequins, now you can never leave me. You'll always be here. And I think to a guy who looks at women like that, that's what a bride would be, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot definitely rolled into that. I think just being at that tombstone and seeing that his mother died in December tells me that this is just a cycle that he goes through leading up to his mother's death.
Yeah, I think you're very right.
quote-unquote normal person throughout most of the year. He is still a maniac, but his killings, I think, don't begin until Thanksgiving time. Also, I think it's hysterical when he is chasing Anna through the cemetery and we are running through, like, the same 10 feet of graveyard over and over and over again. It's like an old Hanna-Barbera cartoon in the back rooms. The backgrounds just keep getting looped around and around. It's so great, but it looks so good. And that fucking moment where, like, she has hit him with a shovel and he's wounded, and now you know she's gotten away, and the jig is up, and his days are numbered, and his fucking mother's corpse comes out of the ground and pulls him toward her. I think that is a great visual moment, because this is the end of him, like, letting her run away and not being able to kill her. You know, thank God. Is the end of his story. There is no way he's getting away with it, and he will be dead soon, if not by his own hand, then by the criminal justice system. And at that moment, it's like the closest he's ever been to his mother. And just for her to in the sense that they're both going to be dead is kind of what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the idea of her pulling him into the grave. I think it's such a great visual cue. When he goes back to his apartment, I'm so, do you not find the end of this movie, like, not redemptive, but
I think it's the most cathartic a movie of this nature could be.
Yeah.
The fact that he is quote unquote murdered by his sick killery fetish of these mannequins coming to life and like killing him. Like,
oh, it's so great. They fucking rip him apart.
And they look great. Like all of the actresses who were these women that he murdered embody the mannequin, like, mannerisms. Like, they have really, yeah, like, elongated hands, and their elbows move strangely, and they do a really great job of still, like, embodying mannequins, even though you know that all the actresses are in the room and there's no mannequins left. It's a really rewarding scene, even though you know it's like he's taking the coward's way out and killed himself, unless something paranormal happens. But the fact that he is visualizing, like, his own failure.
Yeah, like, he realizes he's surrounded by these trophies most of the time, but now he realizes they are definitely just, like, all dark parts of his nature, and, like, he's surrounded by all the horrible things he's done, and it's finally come to roost.
Well, and also, like, in his sick, twisted mind, he has failed them. Like,
good point.
They can't be together forever, and it's his fault.
That's a really good point.
So they're, like, suffocating him, or punishing him.
Yeah. I didn't notice it, but there is a great little touch where the prostitute that he kills at the beginning, who is modeling for him in the room before he starts strangling her, is like, she's asking him, like, you like it like this, like this, like this, and that's, she keeps saying that when while she's killing him. Oh, what a great touch! I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I did not hear it. We have a moment where, like, the cops come and they find him, and he's, rather than being torn apart, he just has like one little knife jammed into his belly, and they back out of the room and close the door.
Case closed.
And just enough time for his eyes to open. Dun, 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 dun. Maniac 2. You always leave room for a sequel.
Yeah, I don't know. John, this movie's just too dark for me, I think.
Yeah, no, you know, I completely understand.
We watched this with a friend. Like, hi, Will. I know you're listening.
Yeah, hi, Will.
It was hard to watch in a group. It was hard to watch with other people watching me and me spilling pop all over myself.
Yeah.
I was really uncomfortable.
Now, last question. Was this movie super uncomfortable and hard to watch because you're a woman? Like, am I phrasing that correctly?
Maybe because I find myself, like, thinking about, okay, if I was alone, like, especially the subway sequence, I think it bothered me more because I've been in vulnerable situations where you think to yourself, like, okay, what would I do if somebody was following me?
Yeah.
Or what would I do if my bus didn't arrive on time? Or, like, there's...
And she does all the things that you would do.
Well, and also, too, like, I can't really relate now to a time before cell phones.
Mm.
And that's kind of scary, because I think, like, being a working woman in a busy city and not having access to a cell phone, like, you can't just check in, even just checking in with somebody so that they know that, like, okay, I'm leaving now, or like, oh, the subway was late, like, you know what I mean? You would arrive home an hour later and be like, oh, the subway was delayed. But nowadays, if somebody's delayed 15 minutes and they don't text you first, like, something is wrong.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something that everybody can relate to, but I don't know. I think as a woman, yeah, you have to... We're a lot more aware of our surroundings when we're alone. And all of these women are, like, independent professional women. Like, one's a model. She lives on her own. There's a photographer. She's a professional. There's a nurse who's commuting. Like, it's, these are, makes me not happy.
Yeah, and like it's also just people working on the street, people sleeping on the beach, people that are just looking for a quiet place to spend some time together. Like, it's, there's no real type that he goes for. It could be anybody.
Yeah, and I think the fact that he still kills couples and just couples that are disarmed makes when he attacks women on their own even worse, because you know that even if you were with somebody, it wouldn't stop him from targeting you.
Yeah.
Like, what?
He's a maniac.
Yeah, spooky.
Yep. So, what's your rating?
I'm gonna give this movie a 1.5 out of 4.
Okay.
That's just like personal preference. This movie is really good. It's got some really great depictions of a serial killer and the way he operates.
Your face right now, it's so, you're just like, I don't want to say these things, but I gotta give it credit.
Yeah, no, like I'm glad I watched the movie, and there's a lot that's really great about this movie, but yeah, like, this is not the type of movie that I would put on.
That's totally fine.
And I feel bad that we made so many people watch it, because I know that there's probably just as many people out there that they're like, yeah, this is not my kind of horror movie.
Well, I mean, that's great, though.
But hopefully some people who like nihilistic stuff like you discover it. And
sure, yeah. I mean, like, I'm happier that you have that opinion, because, you know, even if we both love this movie and we come on here and we say how great it is, somebody who watched it based on a recommendation will not agree. And I'm glad that you have, I'm glad that they have you in their corner.
Like, I respect it, but I do not like it.
That's totally fine. You don't have to. I'm happy that you watched it with me, because I really like it. And I'm sorry that it's not your bag. You know, like, the thing I love about you and about the horror community at large is that you're willing to try it out. You're like, let's watch it. Let's see what it's like. It's just,
you made me try it twice, John.
Yeah. Obviously, the last time wasn't for the podcast, and now I've exercised my power, and I'll probably never be able to get you to watch it again, but like, whatever, I'm gonna watch it. I'm gonna continue to watch it. I think it's a very good movie. I think it's a very hard movie to watch for all the reasons you were depicting, because it is very gritty. And like, in terms of grindhouse horror movies, at least as I've experienced them, because there's a billion of them and I've seen a small pocket of them, it's like a 4 out of 4 movie for me. But like, I mean, like, the acting is not incredible. Like, we make a lot of gaps and stretches, and it is very hard to look at. I do love it as a character study of just an awful human being who has a lot going on. I really do love those scenes where he's talking to the mannequins, because it is so creepy and unsettling and strange. And then he becomes like a little baby, and you're like, am I supposed to feel bad for this guy because these women made him kill them? Like, it's not at all how I'm feeling about it, but it's how he feels about himself. And like, he's a complex character, despite it not being an incredibly complex movie.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's got some stuff against it, but I'm giving it a 3.5 out of 4, because I really, really enjoy it. And I enjoy it partly because of how hard it is to watch, I guess.
How would you feel, though, if 100 movies like this existed?
I mean, if 100 movies like, 100 movies like this do exist, but yeah, if this was the movie that was coming to the theater every single week, yeah, I wouldn't like that. But I think part of the reason I do like watching it is because I don't see this everywhere.
Yeah.
And also, like, for, I think we got to give William Lustig credit for how he approached making the movie, because, like, I'm going to talk about in Henry for sure, it is, to me, an art film that's inside a horror sandbox. Like, I love how it's put together. I think some of the shots are just absolutely brilliant.
I guess maybe I don't know what the film is saying, other than existing for shock value and to be at the precipice of fiction.
Okay. Sure. And I think that's what puts it into the exploitation market, because people want to come see those kind of things. And if we have a movie that is, it is just like the first act of this movie, where we watch him go from kill to kill to kill to kill with no connective tissue and no exploration as to who he is, in the world at large or in his own apartment, in his mind, then it's nothing. Then it is just grotesque and exploitative, and it's got no merit. But because we you know, unfortunately, the movie front loads itself with a lot of like heavy violence. It helps create a world for us to explore the twisted mind that can thrive in those horrible conditions.
Mm.
And it's a lot of like the reasons why I like this movie are a lot of the same reasons that I like 70s cinema, which this is also kind of lumped into. It's that we have a character that is not necessarily good or bad. He is just there, and this is what is happening, and we are watching it.
Yeah.
It's not that we are coming looking for a good time or a bad time. It's that
we're not here for a good time.
Sorry,
or a bad time.
You picked the greatest time to interrupt me too, because I kind of lost what I was gonna say. Like 5 minutes ago, I had it. And I was
you had
like,
some really great points though. Like you honestly just about sold me on this movie. I think personally, I just need my my darkness served with like a little levity. Like
I get you.
My recommendation is if this movie is a little bit too dark for you and you do not, if you're like me and you do not necessarily enjoy these things, but you appreciate cinema that goes there, Christmas Evil.
Sure. You see, that's the thing. Like,
it's just served with like a little bit of whimsy or a little bit of traditional horror fun. There's fun to be had there.
Yeah.
And you still get to explore the psychology of like somebody who's in that like manic Christmas descent.
Yeah, see, it's movies like Christmas Evil that surprise me when you say you don't like Maniac. Or that you can't like Maniac.
Because mm-hmm. you're like, you fucker, you like The Stranger.
Well, yeah, it's kind of the same movie to me. But like I completely get it. It's all in how it's presented. And this movie is presented in a very hard way to look at. But it is a character who we are just following at a specific time. And shock and awe just happens to be part of his everyday life. I don't think the movie is necessarily made specifically for shock and awe. It has shock and awe elements, but they are all because it is part of what makes him, I want to say a human being. It makes him the person he is. He is not a human being. He is, but he's a monster. But yeah, that is just the world Frank lives in, and this is Frank's life, and he's a maniac.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So are you ready to talk about Henry?
Yeah, I'm ready to have this exact same conversation again. Let's talk about Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
You telling me you never killed anybody before?
I ain't saying that.
What do you got in mind, Henry?
What do you think? What do you say, Otis? You want to go grab a beer?
If you shoot somebody in the head with a .45 every time you kill somebody, it becomes like your fingerprints, see? But if you strangle one and stab another, and when you cut up, when you don't, then the police don't know what to do.
You guys need any help? Do you need some help, or can you do it yourself?
That's when you go for a ride on this. It's always the same, and it's always different. Ain't that right?
Sure, it's good to talk to you, Henry. You're not judgmental or anything like that.
Open your eyes, Otis. Look at the world. It's either you or them.
Did I stutter? Give me the $50 and get out!
Don't do that, Otis. She's your sister. Otis, Plug it in.
From 1986, John McNaughton's Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is currently sitting at an 87% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7 out of 10 on IMDb, 3.5 out of 4 from Roger Ebert himself, 80% on Metacritic, and 3.6 out of 5 on Letterboxd.
Okay, so, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, you love
actually,
this one.
Actually, this is a big surprise.
Yep.
I do actually like this movie.
I'm not surprised.
It's, it isn't any less dark than Maniac is.
Nope.
It isn't any less vile in moments than Maniac is, but it's too interesting to be solely abhorred by it. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. And I will say, you're basically... I watched a little video from Siskel and Ebert talking about both Maniac and Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and it's interesting how much Roger Ebert comes to the defense of this movie.
I honestly think it's because we have Becky, and she's like this emotional goodness for us, and we know that when she's in scenes, like, there's somebody that is good and decent there. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, and I think we also are rooting for the humanity of Henry, and we see him hopefully building a relationship with Becky, and I don't know, you want to, it's a weird position to be in, because he's just as cold-blooded as Frank and Maniac, but there's something about him that is just almost like boyish when he's with Becky.
It's funny you say that, because I think Henry's greatest strength is that, maybe not greatest strength, but like greatest secret, is that humanity's never there. I don't think it's ever there. I think there is a presentation of it, but
maybe it's because I look down on Henry's. I don't see him as like a smart or sophisticated serial killer.
Well, I don't think he's
calculated. Like, I think he's purging something inside him every time he kills somebody, and he could only exist in the age he does because he's not careful. He gets fingerprints everywhere. His DNA is everywhere. And that was just something that he didn't, as a killer of that era, didn't have to worry about.
Yeah, and he also talks about having to constantly be on the move and whatnot. But yeah, like, he'd never exist now. And he is like that uncalculated serial killer that you hear about constantly.
So before we get too much into the movie, because I know we kind of dived into it already, this movie had an interesting, like, release, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't really remember it, so I'm hoping you can download me and everybody else.
I mean, like, the TLDR of it is, as far as I remember, is that the MPAA refused to rate it. They didn't even give it an X. Like, it was just the most vile film ever made, was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just didn't exist for years. I think something like 4 years, it had no representation anywhere. It was just, like, a thing 10 people had heard about. And then in 85, I think, it made a few festivals were brave enough, I guess, to play it unrated. And critics took it very seriously. It was really well received to a degree, obviously. Like, I'm sure there were plenty of people talking about how horrible it was, but there were plenty of people saying that, like, this is a great moment in cinema and we need to see it. And then it was released to very, very select theaters unrated. For the longest time, I think it went absolutely unrated. The MPAA basically just refused to touch it. And the interesting thing about Roger Ebert is that he kind of took that as a stance to sort of combat the MPAA by saying that there needs to be something between R and X. And, like, how can we have art films like this that are violent but are intended for adults? How can we not have them play places? Like, R rating is a joke, he said, at least in the 80s, and X is essentially like, oh, this movie's going to be played in a nudie theater, and no one's ever going to see it. There needs to be something in between those two. And I don't necessarily, I can understand why they didn't have the same position on Maniac, but it is always interesting to hear the two of those guys really come to defend very violent movies that have artistic qualities, but at the exact same time, in the exact same sentence sometimes, really shit on the rest of the horror movies being released in the 80s that were being given an R rating, despite the fact that they were just, slasher movies that had a bunch of naked college kids getting killed.
Yeah, like, I think that comes down to, like, violence as escapism or violence as commentary. And Henry does a really great job of presenting two different killers in the same world.
You mean Henry and Otis?
Yeah.
Okay.
And their relationship is an odd one. Like, their journey together is a weird story, but it almost puts you in kind of a villain role, because I don't know if you feel this when you're watching it. I dislike Otis more than I dislike Henry.
Definitely.
And Henry is definitely, like, Henry is the snake in the grass.
Mm-hmm.
Otis is just, like, a baboon who learned how to eat from the snake. Like,
yeah, he's an oaf. Yeah, he's an idiot. And I think that's one of Henry's strengths, like I was saying earlier. Like, you will let him into your house. And we see him do that, literally, in parts of this movie.
Oh, yeah, with the bug spray.
Yeah.
And we don't even see that conversation. Like, that's nope. So fucking artful.
Yeah, I think it's like a knee-jerk thing to say, like, oh, is this movie easier to watch for you because you don't actually see the murders? There's plenty of murder on the movie. I would say probably the hardest murder to watch in the movie is the one you do see.
Yeah. What's also kind of interesting is that we see a lot of Henry's victims up front. And we know they belong to Henry. The title is Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. But we do not get any of the scenes leading up to their death.
Nope.
We just get their corpses and then, like, a light audio of, like, the screams and the trauma of that period in time when they died. It's when they get the video camera that we get to kind of, like, start experiencing how it plays out, and, like, how, like, when he starts to fold Otis into his killings is when we are kind of invited into that point of his life. But for the first third of the film, we get to meet Henry without the judgment of his actions. Like, we see his corpses, we know that they're piling up and he's still murdering people, but we see him, like, have a job, we see him interact with the real world, we see him meet a new girl and not freak her out. Like,
mm-hmm.
We get a chance to, like, meet him and know him without attributing violence to him.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense.
We literally see a girl with, like, a Coke bottle shoved down her mouth, and it's disgusting. It's really jarring. Mm-hmm. But you almost, because we do not see it happen, we almost kind of, like, forget about it.
I think that is the best way to describe it, because I think that's the key, because I think that's how Henry treats it. Henry does something, and then it's in the past. It, like, whether or not it's going to work and getting paid to...
Like, he's not a murderer when he's not murdering.
That's exactly it. He's not a murderer when he's not murdering. He's not a nice guy when he's not talking to Becky. He's not an exterminator when he's not exterminating. Like, that's just it. Henry is just constantly on the move and is constantly not looking back. Like, even when he talks to Otis about killing, it's just, it's done and then it's done. Like, it happens, and then it's over, and then it never happened.
The scenes when he, like, veiled threats him, when he's just, like he basically is telling him, like, nothing happened.
Yeah.
And it's, like, a question, are pretty scary. Because you see Otis getting a little scared, and to see Henry, like, exerting dominance, and you're just like, why are they partnering up at all? And it's something that I do not understand, and I don't think I'll ever get. And so every time we see scenes of them going on these little, like, sprees, I have to watch, because I don't know why. Normally, don't you think serial killers are, like, solitary?
I mean, typically, yeah. That's how I think of them. I don't think that's always necessary.
And I don't...
I think with the majority, it's true.
Yeah, and I don't think Henry necessarily wants the help. Like, I'm sure he appreciates having somebody that can hold somebody down when you're invading a house of three people, but I don't know.
I often wonder.
I don't know why they're together.
I often wonder if it has anything to do with being a very strange apology. Otis attacks his sister in front of Henry, and Henry's not having any part of it. He grabs him by the back of his head. He tells him, like, not to act like an asshole, and the whole scene gets real tense.
It gets really stiff in there.
Yeah.
But why does...
See, they go out for a beer, and instead of going for a beer, they go out and get two girls. Henry kills one in the back seat, and then when the other one realizes what's happening, he also kills her while she's basically still in Otis's arms. And it's not, there's no apology. Like, oh, hey, man, sorry I got carried away.
They just dump them out of the car. That's all
yeah,
they do.
They just dump him out of the car, and then he knows that, like, this is not cool for Otis, so he gets Otis to move over because he's driving, and then they just take off. And then that's where he has this conversation with him about how, like, look out there, Otis, it's either you or them. And, like, that is definitely, like, what you were talking about, like, him basically saying, like, asserting dominance in that scenario. But he so quickly brings him in, and there's no explanation of it. There's no, like, oh, I guess you know this about me now. I guess there's no avoiding it.
Yeah.
It's like it's almost like his apology to sort of bring him closer to who he is as a person is to start killing with him,
mm-hmm.
which is bizarre. You know, so the Henry is based off Henry Lee Lucas, a very real serial killer, who did have a partner who I think
oh, really?
Was also named Otis. And even then, the relationship between the two of them is very muddled and confusing. And it's not certain whether they were in a any sort of relationship, whether they were just partners, whether they liked each other, or whether one of them knew anything about the other killings. Like, the whole thing is strange. Like, strange in the way that, you know, Henry Lee Lucas claims to have killed over 300 people. It's strange that, you know, it's almost damn near impossible strange.
Mm-hmm.
There is a great article on our website, actually, at nofspodcast.com. One of our writers, Tyler, has a column called Behind the Screams where he talks about the real-life stories that inspired some of your favorite horror movies, and it is a very long and detailed article about Henry Lee Lucas and the life that he lived that inspired this film. And it's probably worth mentioning that this film isn't really based on the facts of Henry Lee Lucas. It's more based on the words of Henry Lee Lucas and how he said that he would kill every day or every other day or sometimes two or three people a day. And he just would kill and move on and think nothing of it. But I know very little about the relationship with Otis. And the more I watch this movie, because I've seen this movie a bunch now, I am still not cracking the code about, like, what makes the two of these guys friends.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. They shouldn't like anything about each other. Like, sure, they were friends in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I can buy that for a little while, but, like, once we start to really get into Henry's world, Otis is way too cool with it. And Otis also has his own stuff going on. Like, not even just with his sister, but, like, with the high school boy that's buying pot from him. Like, there's... Otis is maybe the most interesting person
yeah.
in the movie for all of his awful qualities.
I don't know. I think Otis, once he's opened his eyes up to the fact that he can just be a murderer.
Yeah.
And he can just kill people, that it almost becomes a journey in, like, getting your kicks by doing as devious of things as you possibly can. Like, I don't know if he's necessarily into incest or definitely into young teenage boys, but I think the fact that it's wrong and he can just do it anyways is what begins to be what gets him off.
Yeah, it's so strange.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and he also has a very big obsession with watching himself do it. And, you know, there is a great scene where the two of them are just, like, emotionless, sitting watching this family
well,
that they killed.
The weirdest thing about that is we have to watch that whole scene where they, it's like a home invasion where they have the husband tied up and there's a bag over his head and they sexually assault the woman and then they break her neck and then her son comes home before they break
yeah.
her neck and she has to witness him getting his neck broken. It's really uncomfortable. But then we pull out, we're not watching it live, we're watching a tape of it, and Otis and Henry are watching it with stone faces.
Yeah.
Bored almost.
You know, the part of that whole scene that I find most interesting is when Otis starts rewinding it and Henry, very confused, asks him what he's doing. And he's like, I want to watch it again. And it's like, Henry can't understand why he would want to do that. There is still a novelty for him to see what he just did on camera.
I think it's just the technology of it.
Exactly.
Like, video cameras are interesting.
But then once he realizes that this guy likes to just rewatch over and over in slow motion, frame by frame, Henry doesn't get it. Henry just doesn't understand it. Like, it's just...
And that's in, I think that's in him not wanting to look back or, like,
oh, totally.
Not caring to
yeah,
look back.
The novelty was over after the one time. He would probably never rewatch or tape any of his other murders at all.
And the thing about his killings, too, is there's nothing, like, exciting about them. He doesn't take a lot of, at least from the ones that we get to witness, because, I mean, there's ones at the beginning that have, like, the, or the housewife with the burns on her and stuff.
Yeah, there's, yeah.
But, like, he doesn't really take a lot of time. Like, he cracks a lot of necks, and and you know what I mean? He's very toss, they're like, murder, and then toss out the car.
Yeah.
So, I don't see him, even, like, facial expression-wise, taking pleasure out of anything on the planet.
Not at
He's
all.
He's just perpetually bored.
Totally. And I think that is how you would describe your life if you were a psychopath. Like, if you didn't kill somebody, but you were a clinical psychopath or sociopath, I think you would just feel excruciatingly bored all the
time.
So
what do you think about his relationship with Becky then?
This is another reason why this movie is so fucking good.
Tell me about it.
These relationships are complicated. I don't quite get it. I think he is just polite to her because that's how you're supposed to be to people. And also, I'm sure he's experienced in his life that being polite to people is a nice way to get by and be unrecognizable. Like,
when he says, "I guess I love you" in the car, I was just like, oh
fuck, yeah, we will get to that scene. Don't worry. I could do a whole podcast on that car drive. But at the beginning, with the waitress, he tells her, like, it's a real nice smile you got there. Like, that's a little dated in terms of compliments, but he's just being nice because if he was an asshole and he was rude, she'd remember that a lot more than just the nice guy who tipped her an appropriate amount.
Yeah.
He just floats by and is unrecognizable to people.
But I guess maybe because this is the first instance where he's, like, in close quarters with a girl who's vulnerable right now. She's left her abusive husband, who's now in prison for murder, and her kids with her mom. She's in a vulnerable state, and the first guy that's decent to her, she kind of falls for him. Yeah. And he doesn't know what to do with that.
He really doesn't. And
just not a compartment in his body for, like, emotion from women.
Yeah, he can't handle love. He can't give it. He can't receive it. He does not know what to do with it whatsoever. And I think she takes him being shy and unfamiliar, or it's not uncomfortable. It's that he's going into the database and that drawer is empty. Like, there's no reference card for him to pull from. He doesn't know what to do. And I think that's part of why he hates Otis so much in the second half of this movie. It's because Otis is mixing the appropriate times to do the appropriate things. Because for Henry, when you're killing, you're a murderer, and when you're exterminating, you're a working man, and when you're at home, you're polite. It's just, there are faces that he has to put on at different situations, and it would be absolutely crazy for him to put on his psychopath face while going to get cigarettes. So why the fuck would Otis do it while he's at home with his sister? Like, I think he's just like, you're crossing the streams, man. You don't cross the streams.
I also think it's fair to assume, because he also has a mother thing, which is maybe true, maybe it's not true, because there are a lot of stories floating around about what happened to his mom.
I love that they address it, though.
That he might have an issue with, like, the sexualization of women.
Yeah.
Or being sexual at all. Like, maybe he is just so purely straight and narrow asexual. That is why him and Otis butt heads, because Otis is so sexual with his murder, with his sister.
Yeah.
That's what Henry's shutting down. Like, that is inappropriate. Like, we are not sexual at women. Yeah. Those are our mothers. We can murder them and talk to them, and that is all.
I think there's the woman who's floating in the river with a piece of trash. I think she might be naked, but everybody else, like, there are occasionally corpses that we see, they're in various states of undress, but never quite naked.
Yeah, but like the one that had the bottle, she is semi-naked, but she's wearing like a lingerie thing.
She might have just been
asleep. I think she's a prostitute or something.
Okay.
So, like, that still could be a punishment for sexualization.
Sure, yeah. It's like, I do love that they address, like, that complicated history between Henry Lee Lucas, the real person, and his mother in this movie also, because he talks about having killed his mom. Otis says he killed her with a bat. Henry says that he stabbed her, and then 2 minutes later says that he shot her, and Becky calls him on it, and it's like he doesn't have a memory for it.
Isn't it weird? So that's what I think, is I think he just doesn't remember.
See, so there's two ways to go about it. Either he doesn't remember because he's killed so many people and none of them actually mattered to him. Even the one that should, like his mother, like realistically, like
technically that's the first. He was 14.
Yeah, and it seems like that's the one that has some sort of emotional charge behind it. Like, the rest of them almost seem like crimes of opportunity or crimes, like, he can take their money because he doesn't really seem to work a whole lot.
Or
TV, you know? But the mother should be the one that has, like, a strong memory tied to it. Mm-hmm. And either he has killed so many people that he literally doesn't remember, or it didn't mean anything to him when he did it, or, my favorite theory, he never killed his mother. And that's why he kills so many women. And I think that's partly true about maniac also. Like, his mother left him, and he's mad about it, and he wants to punish her for leaving him, and the only, like, the ultimate punishment is...
He will never have the opportunity of killing her.
Himself.
So all of these women are proxies.
Yes, exactly. So I think that's part of it with Henry. But then you would almost expect him to do that all himself then, because there is a reason for it. A very personal reason. So, like, why bring Otis into
like,
it?
Yeah.
It's any one of those things. It's like asking somebody how they got their scars. You know, like, you're not gonna get the right answer.
Yeah. I think, yeah, the answer is either boredom or, like, asexual anger. And
it's crazy.
Not that I think you're angry if you're asexual, but I think he's tying a lot of his emotional connection to the world to his relationship with his mother. And
yeah. Yeah, because, like, he can't. Now, no, don't get me wrong, there is a very thin curtain between Becky Henry and a sleeping Otis, but, like, he really is so uncomfortable when she is trying to get his clothes off.
Like more uncomfortable than when he comes in and Otis is raping her.
He knows what to do in those moments, right? Like, he leaves to go buy cigarettes, comes back, Otis is raping her on the floor. He knows what to do. Kill him. Like, that is a mode he can snap into,
yeah,
no problem.
And the crazy thing, too, is that that scene is so charged because it is, it's the first time, like, we've had the opportunity to fall in love with a female character in this movie that gets murdered. And she's being wronged by her own brother, but then Henry kills him, and then Henry's instantly in Henry the serial killer mode, and he drags Otis to the tub, and he starts cutting off his head and his limbs and throwing them in garbage bags, and... Becky is forgotten because she's like, he got her to be quiet basically so he could think.
Yeah.
And she is like needing therapy in the other room, mm-hmm. but he's doing the body part stuff.
Yep. He's got other stuff to take care of.
Yeah.
Yeah. She is such a sad character.
Oh, I just feel so bad for
it's
her.
It's so bad. Like, she literally leaves her husband, who's like crazy abusive, and gets the fuck out of town. She leaves her daughter with her mother, and she goes to Chicago, where her brother is, to sort of gain some money, bring her daughter home to Chicago, and start a new life. Like, she is doing everything she can to avoid a horrible past, and Otis is no better. Otis is maybe worse than her shitty husband.
She went to live with a serial killer and a horn dog brother.
Yeah, and
who
a
has
serial
no
killer
boundaries.
Entry. Yeah. Oh man. She didn't know that when she came. But, you
so
know.
I want to talk about the ending, and I want to talk about, like, from Becky's perspective and from Henry's perspective, but I want your take on it.
You want me to talk first?
Yes. Like, I want to know, because I honestly I don't think I know what the fuck happens. And the end was like when we zoom in, I'm just like, oh my god, I was fooled! I was foiled!
Sure.
Even when I've seen it, I'm foiled.
So, Henry and Becky leave the apartment. They're planning to go stay... They're just getting the fuck out of town, because previously she had talked to him about going back home, wherever home is, somewhere in the Midwest, I would think, and getting her daughter and the three of them just living there on the farm. Until they had to kill Otis and get out of town real quick. So on the way out of town, they drop Otis's bridge off. They drop Otis's body off a bridge. And then we are in the greatest short film ever made. If this was released to a festival, just the sequence of them in the car, it would be an award-winning short. I think this is like Oscar contention for writing and cinematography and performances. It is so fucking good. Like, they're just sitting there, both shell-shocked, and Henry asks, like, do you want me to turn on the radio? Because, like, what the fuck else are you supposed to do in that scenario? But also, like, it's in the past. Henry's over it. He doesn't care. But, you know, maybe she's bored or something. Maybe she's uncomfortable. Would you like the radio? And then that's where they start having this discussion about how awful things have been, and how she can't get over it, and she's trying to be hopeful. She is looking toward the future, and, you know, like, we'll go stay with your sister, we'll hang out with the horses, my daughter will be there.
Yeah, and I don't think she, great. Like, she doesn't blame him or anything. Like, he's basically gotten off with, like, Becky still has gold stars in her eyes for
she,
him.
He defended her.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more aggressively than she would have liked, but, you know, in some ways... Henry didn't necessarily have a choice. He didn't intend to kill Otis initially, but Otis definitely started trying to kill Henry, and Becky stabbed him in the eye, and Henry just finished the job. It is a uncomfortable stabbing to watch, by the by.
Yeah.
It looks so good in a bad way. But But yeah, then they check into a motel. Like, I'm glossing over the greatest short film ever made, but seriously, like, oh my God.
All caps, the greatest short film
ever made. Greatest short film ever made. Oh, and then, like, we pull out away from the car, and everything goes out of focus, and it's just, that is a brilliant turn. I love it, because we check into a hotel, and then they basically just go to sleep for the night. In the morning, we wake up, we watch Henry doing his morning routine, he puts his bags in the car, he leaves. Then he drops a suitcase off at the side of the road. And if we're doing this all from Henry's perspective, he at some point has killed Becky, either in the morning or at night, chopped her body up in the tub, put it in a suitcase, and left it on the side of the road, and he takes off. I don't really know what to do with my perspective. I think Henry decides that he's going to kill Becky.
In that drive.
I don't even think it's in the drive. Because, yeah, there is that great moment where she says, "I love you, Henry." And he says, I guess I love you too. And then he asks her if she wants to listen to the radio. Like, it is just the fucking, like, most brilliant book ending to a weird scene. I love it. But no, like, we go from there, like, in terms of visual shots, we cut to the poster or the cover that you've always seen for the movie where Henry, in, like, a salmon bathroom, is staring into a mirror, just, like, looking into his own eyes. I think that's where he decides he's going to kill Becky. Because she's off in the other room, and now he's escaped, he's on the move. He's thinking about his next plans and what he needs to do. Actually, you know what? I'm going to nix that. I'm not going to say that he's thinking about his next plans or what he needs to do. But he does decide that he doesn't want Becky around at some point. And then in the morning, yeah, we see him shave and stuff. But there's no mention of Becky because she's not in the picture anymore. The difference between Henry and Becky is that Becky is planning for a future and Henry is not. And I think that is where they really butt heads.
Yeah.
Because she's talking about what we're going to do next and what we're going to do there and how things are gonna go and everything's gonna be
great.
We
need to get my
great.
Daughter.
Yeah, and Henry is just a next 5 minutes guy. Like, and that's all he's thinking about. So for him to sit and plan about a future is not something that his brain necessarily handles. He doesn't think about the past. He sure as shit doesn't think about the future.
Yeah.
So,
and I guess if he thinks about her long enough to be like, oh, she's investing, she's gonna become more of a liability and more luggage, basically.
Yeah. And so he leaves her. It's dark. It's real dark. And I'm glad we don't see her death. I think it's in line with the rest of the movie also. We don't really see anybody that he kills to a degree.
Like solo.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it also, I think, makes it resonate more that she never really actually meant anything to him. The fact that he's able to do like a morning routine and just get in his car. And he's so calm and just going about his day that we're like, wait, where's Becky?
Yeah.
And then we find out where she is.
Yeah.
But there's nothing monumental about her absence.
Exactly.
From the
perspective
of Henry.
Yeah. He is a clinical psychopath. He does not see a difference between her and a television. Like, that is it. Like, there's nothing. There's even a great scene where Otis kicks a TV in, and you would think, like, Henry has more of a reaction to that. They have the exact same reaction to the death of a television as they do to the death of an entire family.
Yeah, I think they were more mad about the TV.
Yeah, I don't know. But, she meant nothing to him. Nobody means anything to him.
And the whole movie, I just want, I don't know why, but, like, I just want them to fall in love. Like, I want her to save him.
You know, it's so funny. I was talking to somebody the other day who knows nothing about either of these movies. And I was describing it like, oh, I watched this movie last night, Maniac. It's about this guy, kills some people, puts their scalps on mannequins and stuff. And I said, I love watching these movies with Kim because there is an introduction of a female character who shows some interest in him. And, you know, despite how awful this guy is, she's like, I just want him to get his act right so they can be together. Like, there's.
I just don't want him to murder her.
That's it. You just like, oh, maybe love will save the day.
And not that I want women to fall in love with serial killers, but in a movie, if you can change him, maybe you can survive.
Yeah, not even necessarily just for Becky, just for the sheer fact that, like, clearly no good guy is coming to save the day. And if an abstract thing like love can be the good guy that gives us a happier ending, then just cutting somebody's body up and leaving him on the side of the road, I'll take it. And that's fine. Like, I feel the same way, too. But, like, sometimes I want a trip to the dark side of town. And that's where my love for movies like Maniac and Henry come from.
Oh, boy.
I want those character studies. If these movies were not from the perspective of the killer, they would not be nearly as effective or enjoyable to watch.
I don't know if Henry is from the perspective of Henry.
You don't think so?
I mean, I can see how you see that it is, especially with the fact that he doesn't look back and like how all the kills are vignettes at the beginning. But I think it has something to do with setting up the audience's relationship to Henry.
Okay, you're right. Because there are definitely plenty of scenes in this movie where we see Otis and we see Becky out on their own. It's not just Henry's story.
Yeah, like when Becky gets her job.
Yeah. She's just like, that is the hardest thing about Becky too, right? Like it's a very standard...
If this was any other movie, she is Julia Roberts in a Julia Roberts story.
Oh yeah, she would have cut the hair of some guy like the waitress. Oh, the hairstylist is out having a cigarette and I need my hair cut now. Like, I'm just the shampoo girl. I can't do this. And yeah, then she cuts a billionaire's
hair.
It's
like sleeping with the enemy. Like her husband comes back and she murders him after he straightens all the cans.
Oh boy.
See? I told you I remember the important things about movies.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, man, that was so strange. We got to do that in the podcast sometime.
We do.
We actually really should.
Yes. We should just, what do we call it? Like, sexy thriller. Is that even a sexy thriller?
Well, that was definitely toward the end. I don't know if it's a sexy thriller.
I think it's just like a dark thriller.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not.
Thriller for women.
I think I'm sure there's a love
interest. I get all thrillers are for women.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've made this point before, and I'm sticking by it, especially if we do that episode. The biggest difference between thrillers and horrors is whether or not you sleep with the killer before they try and kill you.
I mean, I'm sure they exist, but, like, I can't come up with any right now.
No, I guess I'm just...
like, I think you're right.
What?
Okay, are you ready to get to ratings on Henry, or are there any other scenes you want to talk about?
I kind of wanted to figure out what movie we were going to pair with Sleeping with the Enemy, but I guess we can skip to ratings. I don't necessarily have any other specific scenes that I want to talk about. The movie is friggin' great, and if you haven't seen it or you've avoided it, if you're planning on avoiding it based on how, you know, Maniac went and whatnot, it is a great artistic movie that is a character study of a very horrible person.
I mean, there's a few sequences that are pretty hard to watch. We kind of talked about them, but... Overall, like, it's, apart from those moments, there's a lot that's pretty, like, normal about it. Most of the film takes place at a kitchen table.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. I think it's supposed to be that for a person who murders, let's say for a living, what they do is normal, and most of their day is normal, except for when they're murdering. And even then, because they do it so much, it kind of becomes normal. Like, it's always under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just right there. And it could happen at any point. But it doesn't, because there's no reason to. So it's unpredictable.
And maybe that's why he brings Otis in, because it's become so normal to him that it's almost like he doesn't know enough to keep it secret anymore.
I don't even know. Yeah. There's always more to talk about by the time we get to it at the end of an episode. But whatever.
I think we just, it's because we come out of this not with any definitive... conclusions or answers.
Well, we're
everything is a question.
Yeah, we're workshopping our essays as we talk about the movie. So by the time we get to the end, like, no, I got plenty more to say now that I've actually thought about it. But no, we'll skip to ratings. I'll go first, and I'm giving this another 3.5 out of 4. I think this is a fucking amazing movie.
I'm surprised you didn't give it a 4.
I'm surprised I didn't give them both 4s out of 4. Like, I'll be real with you. Like, as far as Grindhouse horror goes, this is a 4 out of 4 in terms of Grindhouse movies. But, like, yeah, sure, it's not as clean as you'd like it to be. Like, some of the performances aren't as perfect. It doesn't necessarily...
There are some moments where it feels like they're walking in and out of a scene. Like, they're just like, this is the kitchen set. And they walk... They're like, let's go to the thing. And then they all walk off the screen.
Yeah.
Like
you just... You can see the constraints of the film in it. But big fucking deal. It's amazing. I love it. And, I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 4. It's fine.
I am going to give Henry a 3 out of 4.
Cool.
This one does have its scenes. It is very hard to watch at times, but this one very obviously poses a lot of questions to its audience. So in that sense, like, it feels like it has, I don't want to say more merit than Maniac, but...
I see what you're saying.
I'm able to...
You don't think a movie like Maniac has anything to say, but Henry definitely seems like a medical analysis through film.
Mm.
Okay.
I think what Maniac is... Maniac's message is in its visceralness, whereas the trauma and stuff that we witness in Henry is so we better learn who Henry is. It's almost like evidence to speculate what kind of killer he is and who he is. But in Maniac, it almost feels like a commentary on violence in cinema and like the merits of violence. I don't know.
That's fine. That's fine. Whatever. You like one more than the other. It's great. It's what movie watching's all about.
And Henry gives you a break. You have characters that you can like. Like, I like Becky.
Yeah.
And I want to see her survive this scenario, and I want her to see her get back with her kid and stuff. So, like, there we have a final girl in this.
Sure.
Even if she doesn't necessarily make it out in the end, we have somebody to root for, and we have, like, a moral center in this film.
I could buy that.
Yeah.
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 I think Maniac by Design is a very insulated film that doesn't want to acknowledge the world around it. The world that Frank lives in Maniac is pretty fucking horrible. And you would say the same thing about Otis and Henry, but we have Becky who's there to bring the real world in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just our opinion. Let us know what you thought of William Lustig's Maniac and John McNaughton's Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer over on Twitter at nofspodcast.com. In the horror movie
Twitter
theme
club. Twitter at nofspodcast.com?
Twitter at twitter.com/nofspodcast. Or just at nofspodcast. That's usually how you look for people on social media. On Facebook at facebook.com/groups/horror fiends of NOFS. And of course, you can always find us on Reddit, the Nightmare on Film Street subreddit, r/Nightmare on Film Street.
Yeah, and like John was saying earlier in the episode, if you're into these... dark movies inspired by serial killers, check out Tyler Listen's column Behind the Screams at nofspodcast.com. You can just search it in the search bar. There are tons of really great analyses of these types of films that have very dark, true inspiration.
Yeah, ranging from Henry Lee Lucas to the Salem Witch Trials. It's all there. Check it out. Highly, highly recommend it.
We are controlling transmission.
Nightmare on Film Street is brought to you by Baphomet & Co., small batch soap inspired by horror and the macabre. This week's pick is the Dybbuk Box, the mystery gift set. Feeling brazen, curious, eager to conjure a little mystery? Baphomet & Co.'s Dybbuk Box contains an array of Baphomet & Co. curated scents, soaps, and bath products that will remain a complete mystery until the box arrives at your door. Get 10% off your order with the code NIGHTMARE at BaphometandCo.com. That's 10% off with code NIGHTMARE. Baphomet & Co. Made by hands, sometimes severed. Want to reach the cool creeps? Advertise with Nightmare on Film Street to get your brand out of the shadows. For more information, head to nofspodcast.com/advertise.
We're going to stick around for a few more minutes and play a little game that I've put together in tandem with this week's discussion of cold-blooded killers. You can get that minigame and every other bonus minigame we record for each episode, as well as drive home from the drive-in reviews of movies playing in the theater right now at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet.
We drop a new episode every Thursday and a full-length episode every other Thursday, so be sure to subscribe if you aren't already so you can get the next one in your feed. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're grabbing this episode. But until next time, I'm Kim.
I'm John.
Stay creepy.
It appears you made it out alive. Just long enough to tell the tale of the Nightmare on Film Street. Ow! Help us grow the horde. Leave a review on iTunes or wherever you subscribe. Continue this week's conversation on Twitter by following at NOFS Podcast. And as always, more terror can be found lurking on our website, www.nightmareonfilmstreetpodcast.com. Until next week, stay creepy, fiends.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.